When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you've missed any of my talk radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Julia. Like listening to your poll, I tell you.
Very interesting, isn't it? I think there are a lot of people, these lockdown sceptics, people who always thought it was terrible infringement, people who proudly take photos of themselves not wearing masks in supermarkets. Yeah. I've never understood all of that. I don't think these are hills to die on that front. But I'm very concerned about these new rules, the massive restrictions on our lives. Christmas being cancelled effectively, you can't, I mean, you know, it depends how big your family is, I suppose. But do you think that the government is doing the right thing?
Well, the government is clearly really worried about the spikes that are coming up, really, in many parts of the country. And they're saying, we feel we have to put rules in place because we tried to do it through persuasion and we don't think enough people are taking our advice seriously. I still hope, as I've told you before on this programme, that people will work out how to live with the virus and will make the changes to their lives. Because I think having government set rules and decide what you may or may not do can't last forever. People will get fed up. And it's really actually having everybody saying, this new virus is something I have to take seriously. I'm going to do it voluntarily.
Yeah.
That seems to me to be important.
And I have to say, I mean, I think the vast majority of people, I mean, you notice the person on public transport who's not wearing the mask. Of course you do. But the vast majority of people, I think, have been very sensible, have obeyed the rules, have done so, you know, with the good spirit, you know, outside clapping for the NHS early on. But the reason for the original lockdown, of course, was that, you know, we had to, and this protecting the NHS, it was a little bit of an issue with that, because I think the NHS is to protect us rather than the other way round. But you know, we didn't know much about this virus. Things were looking really very scary from what we'd seen in China, what we'd seen in Italy. Just to get on top of this, prepare our extra capacity with the Nightingale hospitals until we knew a bit more. Yeah, OK, fine, let's lock down and then we'll come out. Months later, look, a lot of us have been back in the workplace for months, a lot of us out and about, I'm using public transport, thank goodness my child's back at school. There are millions more who are still terrified in their homes. Much easier to scare people in their homes, into their homes, than get them out again. The reality is, this virus is never going to go away. That's not what viruses do. It's never going to go away. But also, we are not going to have a vaccine for this winter. We were always going to have to live with the vaccine through, live with the virus through this winter, weren't we?
Yeah, it could have been me talking. Virus not going away. We're going to have to live with it for the foreseeable future. So we have to find ways to get on with our lives whilst holding the virus back. It's like being on a constant state of defence. Partly it's how we behave, and partly it's how local areas, local authorities and health people organise themselves so that there's things like the testing, tracing and isolating can work as well as possible. And then with that defence in place, we just get on with life. And that's still my destination, Julia. That's where I want all countries to get to. And I suppose I'm saying the present is the period while we work out how to deal with it. And these slightly unfortunate situations where we're asked to do things that we really don't really want to do. I hope that's temporary and that we will come through this, changing our behaviour and learning to live with this unwelcome new presence in our world.
Indeed. I mean, if everybody was, you know, wearing a mask and in public places where they could pass it on, if everyone was washing their hands regularly and social distancing, yeah. I meet up with friends, we go to restaurants, we've had people in our home, but we don't hug each other anymore. You know, we had a big conversation about, well, do we hug grandparents when we see them and the like. And if we were all doing that, we wouldn't be in this trouble. It is really noticeable that infections have gone up massively. I mean, just massively in the younger age group, 17 to 21-year-olds. Way, I mean, just huge increase, and basically all the way up to 30 as well. But I mean, these will be young people just basically at the prime of their lives, freed from everything, finally getting to see their mates again, and they've all frankly gone a little bit crazy. A lot of this, frankly, I think parents need to be, you know, sending the message to their youngsters. How big a worry should it be that these infection rates in the young are actually going to affect older people, given that the vast majority of young people, I mean, when I say vast majority, I mean 99.9999999% won't even need to go to hospital, let alone die.
Well, I want to hold on that last point. I don't want, again, to be a misery guts, but actually one in 20 or so of younger people who get this virus don't get better quite as quickly and easily as it used to be said. We're seeing there's something called long tail COVID, which is basically you stay quite tired. You also are not as fit as you used to be. It's generally an unpleasant thing and it doesn't go away.
Talk Radio Breakfast with Julia Hartley Brewer and The Times. Be well informed.
Well, let's talk about all this now with Richard Tice. He's chairman of the Brexit Party and businessman. And Richard, we do want to talk about Brexit and the latest shenanigans over all of that, but I must get your thoughts. I know you've been quite outspoken on the issue of getting people back to work, getting people back in the workplace and the lockdown. What's your reaction to the latest restrictions on our daily lives?
Good morning, Julia. Well, I'm truly appalled by these latest huge restrictions that the government is imposing. It's totally unnecessary, Julia, when you look at the data. Now, this is a government and a prime minister who've always banged on about relying on the science. Well, firstly, you know, scientists agree as much as economists do. But the data, the real data shows that actually, when you look at the number of hospitalizations and the number of deaths, they are bumping along record lows.
But they're all going up. Now, hospitalisations and deaths have gone up by a very, very small number.
By a tiny percentage. You've got more chance of dying of flu here in England than you have of dying of the virus. When you look at the percentage of people who are tested, who test positive with this disease, it's less than 2%. This is a complete overreaction to a disease that actually we are now basically on top of. You know, younger people are getting the virus. We're treating it much better using remdesivir and dexamethasone. And, you know, we need a government that starts to say to people, you can't eliminate risk. You've got to manage and mitigate it. But we've got to get on with our lives. We've got to get on with kickstarting the economy again. We've got to try and protect our city centres. We've got to come to terms with the change in our working lives and try and get a win-win out of part working from home, part getting back into the office. You know, we cannot prejudice our children and our grandchildren's, you know, lives and future generations with this appalling dictatorial way of running one of the greatest democracies in the world.
Are you going to comply with the new COVID rules? I've been really, you know, very, you know, assiduous about trying to do the right thing. I think of myself as a law-abiding person, but I feel some of this is a step too far for me living in a free democracy.
You're absolutely right, Julia. And the truth is that the government has lost the confidence of the people because of its continuing incompetence on so many issues. And I think the majority of people recognise that the government has completely misinterpreted what's going on. And I think the majority of people, myself included, will say, do you know what? I think I'll work out what represents a risk to others and, you know, we will apply our own judgment. And that's what you do in a free and democratic society. So, you know, I think we're in a very difficult place. I think the government's completely misjudged and misread the data. And it's not good. And you know, the implications for businesses, for jobs are truly appalling. You know, people who've just started to reopen up and start investing again, you know, are they going to continue to do so, or are they going to say, no, I've got to hold back?
That's the fear, isn't it? Like, I mean, I have to say, look, I don't think people like Chris Whitty, you know, misread the data. It seems to me it's your willingness to take what you consider to be reasonable risks in your life. And we can leave a COVID risk life. Unfortunately, being COVID risk free means you have loads of other risks. As we know, we're seeing people dying of cancer and heart disease because they're not getting treated. And we're going to see God knows how many deaths as a result of the massive lockdown. And when we do actually start seeing those mass job losses that we are going to see at the end of that furlough scheme, I think a lot of people are going to feel very differently. I think we are heading into a very, very difficult winter. Let me talk also about the other thing we're told we're supposed to be fearful of. Again, how willing are you to take a risk that life outside the EU will be terrible or not? We've got the Brexit trade deal negotiations still going on. Prime Minister pressing ahead yesterday with the publication of the UK Internal Markets Bill. Being told that this basically plan to override parts of the withdrawal agreement he signed, saying, oh, we didn't go into the details. Was done too quickly. We know the Prime Minister's not a details man. The suspicion now, look, this is entirely just a way of trying to force movement from the EU. It's a high-risk strategy. It's upset people like Sir John Major, who says it's going to damage Britain's standing on the world stage. I always think it's a good day when John Major's unhappy. This is a breach of international law in a very specific and limited way, and it's all a bit of game playing. Is this brinkmanship, or is this a risk to our national reputation as a country that follow international law?
Not at all. That's complete nonsense. It's interesting, isn't it? The people who are bleating loudest about all of this are those who actually didn't want Brexit. They then wanted to try and stop Brexit. The likes of John Major, you know, Dominic Grieve, David Gawk, all these people. The truth is that what this bill does is iron out some very technical issues regarding trading in different parts of the United Kingdom. We are a sovereign nation. We're perfectly entitled to organise the trade and the technical issues around it, most of which are far too boring to bore people with, within our own nation. And the withdrawal agreement entitles us to do that under something called Section 38, which says that our sovereignty overrides everything else. You know, so we're perfectly entitled to do this. And the truth is that the European Union, they have demonstrated bad faith throughout these negotiations, which puts them in breach of the withdrawal agreement themselves. And for them to say that we've broken the letter and the spirit of the agreement, you know, frankly, is a bit rich coming from them when you see how they're trying to negotiate on things like fishing and state aid with the political declaration and the future trading arrangement. They're in breach, in my view, and therefore, yes, look, there's some tough negotiations, but really and truly, this is a complete, it's a song and dance about, frankly, not a lot. I think our Commonwealth partners around the world will respect us for looking after our own internal trading arrangements.
OK, well, we shall wait and see what happens. Richard Tice, Brexit Party Chairman, very much appreciate you joining us.
Talk Radio Breakfast with Julia Hartley-Brewer and The Time.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Know your times.
Coming up, I'm delighted to welcome the Transport Secretary Grant Shapps to the show. Good morning to you.
Morning, Julia.
Well, so you've been tasked with trying to appease probably a pretty angry, miserable, depressed nation today after the announcements from the Prime Minister yesterday. This rule of six, the threat of a 10 p.m. curfew. We've seen what's happened in Belgium. COVID marshals with their little clipboards and their high-vis vests. Restrictions possibly lasting until March. And Christmas, realistically, for most families, being cancelled. Are all of these restrictions actually justified for a disease that we, a virus that we are now very much more in control of, which largely kills the very elderly and the very ill and leaves virtually everyone else unscathed? Is it really justifiable to impose these restrictions on people living in a free democracy for that virus?
Yeah, look, we've been down this route before, haven't we? We know how this works. If we do nothing right now, we know that the virus will double in a couple of weeks, and then it turns into a week and then into 3 days. And we know that that's the trajectory of this virus. And we know that because we've been through it before. But actually, we're also seeing the numbers increase elsewhere. And, you know, a month or two ago, when we saw the numbers start to increase in Spain and then in France, we could have had the same conversation. And what we're seeing in Spain, for example, is that the number of deaths is now starting to move upwards as well. So I don't think the fact or the epidemiology of the disease has changed one iota. And unfortunately, unless we take action, then there'd be far worse action required, which we had before. We're not going into a second lockdown. And we're not, by the way, introducing 10 p.m. curfews either.
Well, 10 p.m. curfews, Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, was pointing to what happened in Belgium and how they were able to flatten their curve. Yeah, but they did that by introducing, among other measures, 10 p.m. curfews. And we're talking about 10 p.m. curfews in areas with high rates. I would not be so certain. Are you telling me categorically right now there will be no 10 p.m. curfews nationwide across this nation in the next coming few months?
As you know, we've been in a complete lockdown before now, so I can't promise you
exactly.
Anything.
Exactly, so we can't promise that's not happening. Okay,
we do want to localise it this time, Julia, okay. as you pointed out.
Except we're not localising it, are we? Because this rule of six is applying across the board. Now, you said, look, if we do nothing, but we're not going to do nothing. The Imperial College computer models, which have proven to be really quite inaccurate now, we've got much more information about the virus. 250,000 people would die. That's why we had to go into lockdown. Again, that was if we did nothing. Other countries, have had worse or better rates of deaths on this coronavirus, but everyone has done something. Even Sweden, famously not having a lockdown. They have actually had a lot of people social distancing. If we carried on with the hand hygiene, the social distancing, if perhaps the bars and the restaurants where these young people who were getting the virus were mixing were better policed, that would be probably enough to curtail this, because we do know more about the virus and we do know who dies from the virus and we do know who's most at risk. Would it not make more sense, instead of putting restrictions on the entire nation, to police the rules that are currently in place in public places, like with a young people out partying, but also to perhaps offer more shielding to the elderly, to the vulnerable, and then say to everyone else, frankly, you know, you're going to have to take your chances. This virus isn't a big risk to you. You may catch it. You may die, but life is not without risk. And there are more bigger risks if we do actually effectively go into some semblance of lockdown. Shouldn't the government be a bit more grown up and treat us as the grown-ups we are and allow us to assess our own level of risk as otherwise healthy, normal people of working age?
I'm all up for people assessing their own level of risk. People, though, this is not something where, you know, you go skydiving and you know there's a level of risk to you. This is something where that risk transfers to other people, your loved ones, or possibly people you've never met, quite likely people you've never met, who then get ill themselves, and some of those people will die. We know that 41,000 people have died. So it's not something which is only a matter of personal choice. But I do agree with you when you said, shouldn't we just sort of clarify the rules and let's police it better? One of the complications we had is obviously the initial lockdown was pretty straightforward. You stayed at home. There were only four reasons why you could leave a home. We then get into the period that we've been going through where, life's starting to get back to normal. But some of the rules have become quite, I think, complicated and confusing. And, you know, for example, two households only. You could have six people from different households outside. But if you went into a restaurant, for example, that could only be two households. How many people knew that? How many people were going in? You know, so it had become, I think, too much of a patchwork. The rule of six is very straightforward, isn't it? You know that if there's more than six people in a social setting, in home, outside a home, in a pub, in a restaurant, you've got it wrong. And that will make it much easier to enforce. And one of the things the enforcement agencies, the police, were saying is, look, actually, people just need a simple rule that they can follow. It will be the law. Simple to follow. Okay. And I think if we do that, then we can get these rates down again.
Well, it's simple to follow. Otherwise, will it actually save lives? So I'm in a situation. I've got a husband and a daughter at home. We want to meet up with a couple of friends of ours who've got two kids. Kids are at the same school. We're real friends. We've seen each other throughout. That'd be seven of us. Now, that we would be committing on Saturday, we're allowed to do it. On Monday, we're committing a criminal offence, and all the adults could be fined £100 if we refuse to disperse, if the police decide to knock on the door. However, I could, on Monday, meet up with five other people from five separate households, and that wouldn't be an offence. Now, which do you think is a bigger risk of spreading the virus? Me meeting up with one other family, which involves seven people, or me meeting up with five other separate households? I mean, you know the answer to that. It's insane.
Well, as you can imagine, we had pretty extensive conversations about this with the chief medical officer and chief scientific advisor, because you're right that there is in any system a degree of an arbitrary line that has to be drawn. And what we've seen is essentially if you try and make that line too squiggly, if you try to introduce too many, but if it's this situation, then do this. And if it's that, then do that. People then get confused by the rules, and actually with best will in the world, some people may just not understand which rule they should be following under different circumstances. This simplifies all of that. And I understand what you're saying. My example is we're in a family of five. There are five of us. If I want to see both my parents or both my wife's parents, we can't see them all together as seven of us, indoors or outdoors or in a restaurant or in a pub. And that is very, sad for us.
It's not just sad. Grant, it's stupid.
The spread of this disease.
Grant, it's stupid because if you see your mother and then 2 hours later you see your father and they live in the same household, they could spread it to each other anyway. So therefore, you've introduced and you're backing and you are currently defending as a government minister a rule that you know right now. I know that you know it's a stupid rule. I know it's a stupid rule. Everyone listening knows it's a stupid rule.
No, I don't agree.
It's not going to save any lives. You not seeing your mum and dad at the same time is not going to save a single life.
I don't agree, and here's why. We already discussed the way that people respond to rules as they get more complicated. And I bet a lot of people didn't realize that it was okay to have six people outside from different households, but you couldn't do that inside a restaurant, for example. It just got too complicated for people to be able to simply follow the rules. And so having a line in the sand where you say this is on the right side and this is on the wrong side, I know it's a little bit blunt, but it does make it easier to follow. Because it's easier to follow, it's easier for the authorities to interpret, it's easier for pubs and restaurants to interpret, it's easier for the police to interpret, and we'll actually therefore keep the virus down.
A lot of the police didn't seem to know what the rules were when they were very simple about the lockdown. So in terms of enforcing it, tell us the powers of these COVID marshals. What powers are they going to have? I'm assuming they're going to have clipboards and high-vis vests, so they're going to feel terribly important.
Well, they'll be able to remind people, for example, if they're about to go into a shop, that you need to be putting on a face covering.
Remind people? Are they able to enforce it?
Why do we need reminding? Because we all need reminding of these things. I was out and about yesterday and I was about to walk into a station. There was actually somebody there in a purple jacket. These are people we call journey makers. And actually just having those people there, just visually seeing someone, just like, oh yeah, of course. You know, we're living in different times. You put the face covering on. And I think that's a very useful reminder. In my area, well, in Hatfield, we have people with street wardens. They're not police. They don't have those types of powers. But what they are very good at doing is reminding people, perhaps if things look like they might get a bit unruly, that there's people there who are able to provide people direction, keep a sense of order. Ultimately, the police are the people who have to enforce.
They won't have powers. They won't actually have any powers.
No, but the whole purpose of having this straightforward rule of six is if you break that rule, the police can ask you to be dispersed, that the marshals could, of course, alert to the problem. They can fine, as you correctly said, and in the end, they could possibly arrest as well, but we very much hope we don't have to get
there. Let's talk about Christmas Day. Lots of headlines are Christmas is cancelled. Prime Minister all very apologetic, but, you know, and again, I have to do this. I mean, he doesn't have to do this. There are always choices. But Christmas Day, so I've got, you know, I've got brothers and sisters, I've got, you know, parents, step-parents, they're you know, kids, quite a lot of us. Normally we'd have, you know, 12 to 14 people. If we went ahead and did that, we'd be breaking the law, we'd be fine. Realistically, unless you're going to be sending the police to every single person's household, how are you going to police that on Christmas Day? Yeah, do you expect people will actually ruin their family Christmases for this?
Well, first of all, we're not at Christmas yet. And I thought it was interesting, actually, when Chris Whitty was asked about the timing for this yesterday. He said, it's probably not 3 weeks that we need to have it in, it's longer. It hopefully won't be months and months, and Christmas is still a way away, and we'll have to see what we're able to do. And I suppose the hope is, if we can all follow this and we can get the R number down below one again, then of course we'll be able to review the rules before Christmas, but we'll have to wait and see. And secondly, to answer your question, yes, it would be breaking the law. I'm afraid we've been here before. There was a point at which it was actually illegal to be outside your home for any one of our, apart from four reasons, and you'd be breaking the law in Britain in the 21st century if you were. But we all accepted that during the main part of the lockdown, and I think people will accept here. We have policing by consent, don't we?
Yeah, we do, but we were doing that because we were supposedly protecting the NHS, which could become overwhelmed. There's no evidence the NHS came close, even remotely close, to being overwhelmed. We've got the Nightingale hospitals. There's no reason for us to go into lockdown to save the NHS. The NHS needs to be fully functioning. We need to be out and about.
So I think the thing about a virus, as we saw in the earlier days and as we went into the peak, is you get the doubling thing, and then double, and it becomes a very, very fast growth rate and gets out of control. And that's how, you know, let's not forget, at the height of things, hospital admissions were over nearly 3,500 people being admitted to hospital per day. If that had doubled again and doubled again in a very short period of time, then we certainly would have required the spillover. We didn't.
Well, because we provided it. Yeah, so yeah, we had the Nightingale Hospital to provide that, didn't we?
I suppose what I'm trying to say is, in answer to your point, the difference between success and failure is the extent to which people follow the rules, and actually can be quite marginal. And therefore very important that people do follow the rules. Otherwise, you do get the doubling taking place.
All right. And our only hope for you not to have to choose between mum and dad and who you invite on Christmas Day, I don't know whether Mrs. Shapps gets a say in this or not, so we can have no more than six on Christmas Day, is this moonshot, we're told. This attempt to bring in some sort of very rapid test, where presumably you cut out the laboratories and people have a test, they can get the results within 20 minutes. We've heard so many conversations over the last few months, 6 months onwards, about an antibody test that would be the game changer, the immunity passports, the antigen testing on a huge scale. Yes, we've upgraded our scaling of our testing, but we're looking at having millions of tests instead of, you know, 250,000 a day. This isn't a moonshot, is it? This is a long shot.
A moonshot, by its very definition, is something which is very difficult to achieve, but that we think is worthwhile. And you're right, you know, completely level with you, there have been things during this coronavirus, there's no manual for tackling a global pandemic. There have been things which have worked well, there have been things that haven't. The things that have worked well have included getting 30,000 ventilators, mostly made in Britain, up from, I think we had about 7,000 at the beginning of this, building those seven Nightingale hospitals in days, now being able to test 300,000 people a day, and we've got that going up to 500,000 with Charnwood and Newport coming online. So and by the way, being you know, the first country to discover treatment that actually works and saves lives in dexamethasone. So it's not like some of these things don't come off. And I think that we do have to be ambitious. It's not our only hope to save Christmas, though, just to slightly correct that point. Actually, we can save Christmas by absolutely following the rules of six that we've talked about today.
And the only way we're going to avoid a second full national lockdown, and BMA have got a leaked memo this morning saying the Prime Minister believes there is our only way avoiding a second national lockdown before a vaccine, is having that capacity for 10 million tests. We've never reached any of the targets realistically in terms of the number of people testing so far.
I want to take you up on that. I remember very clearly when the Health Secretary said we would get to 100,000 tests, and everyone's like, oh, it won't be possible. But guess what? We got to 100,000. We're now on 300,000.
That was for one day at that moment. Look, there were some question marks about that. But getting to a few hundred thousand is quite different from getting, say, 10 million tests a day. Isn't
Which is why it's a moonshot. You're absolutely right. It's
so
not
we're going to have
bag.
A second
it's
lockdown.
Straightforward. But would you prefer that we didn't have ambitions to do this, that we didn't have plans?
Do you know what I would prefer? I think an awful lot of people. I love the fact we're looking at the vaccines. I love that. Yeah, we've got to do all of that. But I think what this government, what this country would prefer, people like me who've been very supportive of the government and supported the lockdown. I'm not a skeptic about it. I'm realistic. I think a lot of my listeners would feel what we really want is the government to just plod on with a lot of the really boring, dull stuff of getting a capacity up, getting those labs working, so we can get people getting tested quickly and upscaling and doing the dull groundwork that does make a difference to saving lives, rather than big gestures.
Yeah, look, you've got to do both is the simple answer. And the very dull, boring stuff is, as you say, making sure hands, face, space, getting those very, very important messages out there. You mentioned it already at the beginning of the interview. It's a bit dull. You might think it doesn't work. It absolutely does work. There's a brilliant video I saw from the NHS last night, which sort of shows how the virus is able to spread through the hands, face, space thing, or reinforces that message. Okay. Very dull, very boring, very, very, very important. And we do have to keep on with the day by day, drudgery of trying to beat this virus. I'm afraid the rule of six is part of that. Okay. But we also want to, lift our sights and do the big things. We've now contributed billions to the global effort to beat coronavirus, to the World Vaccine Alliance. And the like. And, we have one of the, or at least two, actually, of the leading vaccine.
Yeah, I'm very proud of our efforts on that front. We're going to have to leave it there because I know your team are going to be shouting at my team for me carrying you over far too long. But Grant Shapps, Transport Secretary, I do appreciate you joining us and answering all our questions and taking the time. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.